But more importantly, I don't want this to just be a regular workshop. I call it demystifying mental emotional health care for a reason. Number one, every group that I talk to, if I ask them, do we need to do more for mental health and addiction services? The answer is always yes. The problem is most people don't know what to do from there. And so I argue that a lot of people, even particularly with this environment, when you're talking to clients, when you're talking to families, when you're talking about let's try to help you accomplish either the goals that they set or what you want them to do, oftentimes they nod, yes, I understand. And then we wonder why they don't follow through. Or then we wonder why they're doing all the right things and yet they fall off and end up back in jail or revoking, etc. So I want to talk about, zoom out a bit to look at more of mental health and addiction prevention as opposed to crisis management. And I'm going to talk about family systems, emotional dysfunction, level of care education. I'll talk a bit about Columbus Springs and services offered. But more importantly, what should a mental health care plan look like for yourself and maybe for your clients? So what qualifies me to be here? So I do work for a hospital, but I didn't study mental health or addiction in school. I don't have any letters behind my name. I am not a counselor or a therapist. However, thanks to probation officers like yourself, I used to get in a lot of trouble when I was younger. I was arrested 4 times in 3 years. I was on the verge of being revoked and going to jail for 6 months or a year if I couldn't get my stuff together. And a probation officer by the name of Jay called me into his supervisor's office, and I thought they were going to give me an award for paying my fees on time, for showing up to meet my probation officer every week. But they said, something seems to be wrong with your urine test, and not only with the last one we took, but the last 9. And if you don't get your stuff together, you're going to come stay at one of our Gray Bar Hotels, also known as the State of Texas County Jail. And so they forced me into treatment. And so September the 10th, which is going to be about 31 days from now, 2001, I'll have 21 years in recovery. And what that means for you guys is every single thing that I'm going to talk to you about, counseling, therapy, support groups, personal development, all the other modalities, community education, family groups, I've been participating in that for 21 years. I have thousands of hours of working with people like your clients, also families like yourself of trying to navigate mental health and addiction and personal development as a whole. So what are we going to talk about first? If we're really going to normalize mental health and addiction. I kind of addressed this a little bit. We are at a point right now, family, where everybody knows we have a crisis. If you ask the criminal justice system, if you ask our politicians and government, if you ask the healthcare system, the mental health care system, our schools, our insurance companies, and our communities, everybody knows we have an issue. However, those sections of government and industry, schools, government agencies, grants, criminal justice, healthcare, they're not exactly known for quick decision making. I'm sure y'all can attest to that. Y'all probably been talking about making changes that have been on the books for years, but they're slow to change, right? So what do we do? This is often something where I have families at schools that are complaining that they need more services. What are we going to do if a school is 5-10 years out from where they need to be? What are we going to do when our criminal justice system is 5-10 years out from where they need to be? Do we sit around and wait? Or do we figure out what we can do in our own communities and in our own homes to start making the changes? But really, if we want to make real headway with normalizing mental health and addiction, we've got to go way back, right? Not just what's going on in our house, not just what our parents did to us to cause us trauma, our grandparents. We got to go way, 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 way out. Anybody ever heard of the term epigenetics? Epigenetics. Epigenetics. So this is, in the most simple way, Epigenetics is part of our genome, which is like our DNA. We can't change our DNA. But on top of our DNA is what we call the epigenome, right? This is, think in terms of the software on our phone. The phone that we have is the hardware. It's like our DNA. You cannot change it. But the apps, what runs in the background, is the software. So if something traumatic happens, or we have a bug, or we get sick, we go in, we change the software, and we can fix the phone. Epigenetics basically gives our body the ability to turn genes on and off. Again, these are very simple explanations. Let's pretend like your great-great-grandmother had a dormant cancer gene, right? She had a gene that makes her more susceptible to cancer, but it was dormant and it was off. And let's say your grandmother went through a really, really traumatic experience that somehow turned that gene on, right? So she had this cancer gene, it was off, she went through a traumatic experience, it turned on, but that doesn't necessarily mean she's gonna get cancer. What's significant about that is she can now pass it to her kids, her grandkids, and great-grandkids. So that is what, that's a simple version of epigenetics. This podcast, it's a Radiolab podcast. It's really not called Grandpa Ate What. However, it's about what our grandparents ate back in the day. So there was a small community in Sweden, which is 10 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Picture Canada, but on the other side of the world, right? 5 miles north of the Arctic Circle, there's a small community, and they had the most extensive modern human record in our modern time. What I mean by that is a lot of our history, our cultural history, our tribal in different parts of the world history was burned and trashed, right? We don't have it anymore, because when someone would get taken over, a tribe would take them over, they'd burn everything down and they'd start their own. So we don't have a ton of like really extensive modern data points. This town did. They have hundreds of years of data on when their people were born, when they died, who they were related to, what did they die from? Did they have mental health, which they didn't call it mental health back then, but did they have heart disease? Did they have mental health? Did they die of cancer, etc.? What they also did was they tracked their food in the form of tracking their farming. So imagine, hundreds of years ago, 5 miles north of the Arctic Circle, they would have years of feast, which means warmer environment, a warmer climate where they could actually harvest a good amount of food. Everybody ate like kings, right? They had feast. They would also have years of famine, which means that the climate was very, very cold. It'd freeze all the food and they wouldn't have anything to eat. So follow me here. This is very, very important. So what they found in this study was, if your grandfather between the ages of 9 and 12 years old. Imagine this. Your grandfather, between the ages of 9 and 12 years old, if he lived during a time of famine, that means cold weather, no food, a lot of people died, some survived, right? If your grandfather, between the ages of 9 and 12, lived during a time of famine, he passed on a health benefit to his kids, grandkids, great-grandkids, great-great-grandkids. In other words, if your grandfather lived between the age of 9 and 12, starved but didn't die, his kids, grandkids, great-grandkids lived an average of 30 years longer, had less rates of heart disease, diabetes, and weight issues. Isn't that interesting? The opposite is also true, that if your grandfather lived between during a time of feast, which means he had plenty to eat between the ages of 9 and 12, your grandfather passed on a health negative to your kids, grandkids, and great-grandkids in terms of they live 30 years less. So they have higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of of weight issues. So imagine this. Most of us don't even remember what the heck we were doing between the ages of 9 and 12. Much less our great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, what they were doing, what kind of stresses that they were under. And this is talking about something that we can physically track. What someone ate, if they got sick or not, and when they died. You feel me? What they ate, what they got sick from, and when they died. What about the mental and emotional impact of how your great-great-great-great ancestors were under? Was there physical or emotional stress in the home? Did they, were they part of a war? Did something happen to their close family members? In today's terms, are they a product of divorce? Were they adopted, right? You've got physical measurables, which we know today can be passed down from generation to generation to generation. But what about the mental and emotional aspects? One thing that is really current is we all either know, especially this group, you know people that use drugs and alcohol while pregnant, right? It happens every day. Mother is an addict. They can't stop using. Baby is born addicted to some substance. But what about being addicted to cortisol and adrenaline? They also track, this is more of an epigenetic bit, they also track that if mom had a tough pregnancy, if mom was in a stressful relationship, if mom's body just didn't handle it very well, there was tons of adrenaline and cortisol, that baby can become addicted to adrenaline and cortisol. What does it look like in real world terms? They like the gossip, even from a little kid. They like gossip. They like drama. They like chaos, right? Often, these stressful environments breed other stressful environments. That's why we typically hang around people that act like us. I call it my flavor of dysfunction. We typically gravitate around people that have our similar lifestyle. And many people don't even track that could have been passed down just from mother and how stressful her pregnancy was. Two things, a couple of resources. Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey wrote a book called What Happened to You? So instead of with your clients, or whether you ask it outright or you think it, which is, what's wrong with you? Why do you keep doing that? Why do you keep ending up here? And start asking the question, what happened to you? What happened in your childhood? What happens from your family history? That's a great book, What Happened to You by Oprah and Bruce. And then the other one many of y'all have heard of is called The Body Keeps the Score. That's where they tracked PTSD in Vietnam veterans and war veterans. And then a 12-step support group, which really focuses quite a bit on this, is the ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunction. Just a couple of resources in case you're curious. What's next? Here is a big, an impactful perspective that if we're going to move the conversation in normalizing mental health and addiction services and demystifying mental and emotional health care, a lot of us like to throw this around about how big of an issue mental health and addiction is today. Like, every generation has it. I remember my parents used to say, "Oh, the drugs today are so much stronger, right? They're killing people left and right." I'm 42. They're so much stronger. It's so much worse today. It wasn't like that when we grew up. Well, now I'm finding myself say the same thing about the younger people. The drugs are so much stronger. We didn't struggle with these things, which some things are true, but this is a guy from back in the 80s. 1988, John Bradshaw, he's a family systems therapist, and he says 96% of our families are in some way, shape, or form, emotionally impaired and dysfunctional. Hear what I'm saying here. Everyone often talks about we have a mental health and addiction problem, right? But our boy Mr. Bradshaw is talking about, we don't have a mental health and addiction problem. We have a emotional dysfunction problem. What does that mean? That means what happens when I get squeezed. When I get squeezed, when I feel the pressures of life, when I get stressed, when I get anxious, right? When I get excited, when I get filled up with joy, how do I handle those situations? And in our society, particularly in the industries that we work in, is we are typically only dealing with the one that have acute mental health or addiction issues, right? That's like the tippy top of the pyramid in severity, right? So it's only about 10 or 15% of our population have acute mental health or addiction issues. Meanwhile, we think everybody else is normal, right? But if we would look at emotional dysfunction, what that would do is open the probability for us to look at us as a community, as a family, not just the one that has the biggest issue in the family. Here's the other thing that's interesting about that is, if 96% of our communities and families have some form of dysfunction, emotional dysfunction, what is their flavor of dysfunction? What does their flavor of dysfunction look like? Let me explain. Does their emotional dysfunction show up in using drugs and alcohol? Does it show up in using people, places, and things? Does it show up in yelling, screaming, hitting, whether it's with family or, you know, people outside? Does it show up in work? Am I a workaholic? Am I codependent? Am I always trying to fix, manage, and control? Am I working 60, 80 hours a week? Does my dysfunction show up in spending? Do I spend money before I have it? If you're like me, every time I say I'm not going to buy a pair of shoes, I show up and Ron said, yo, you got another pair of shoes. What's going on with that? Right? So everybody has some form of mental and emotional dysfunction. But it's often, if you're anything like me, I like to blame and point the finger. So if you're worse than me, I like to say you got the issue and I don't. Right? So what I want to do is if we're going to normalize mental health and addiction, I want to broaden the concept of emotional dysfunction to see if we can make some way in normalizing mental health and addiction. This is a really good slide about some of the different variations of emotional dysfunction. This is a little bit more clinical, on the clinical side, but these are different family types many of y'all heard of the ACEs. This talks quite a bit about ACEs, but these are like five different family types that mirror the gold standard in family dysfunction. One, perfectionistic. These are families with very high expectations. Praise is tied to performance and emphasis on perception, which is what I want you to see and who I want you to think I am is different than I am at home. If you're anything like me, they would say things like, what happens in this house stays in this house, right? Let's make it look good on the outside. Meanwhile, in my home or internally, I don't feel good about myself. That's perfectionistic. Number two, militaristic or overly strict. So these are rigid rules, physical or verbal abuse, harsh punishment, extremely secretive, right? Don't tell anybody. Don't let anybody in. What's also significant about this, and we'll get into it a little bit more later, but is if you were raised in a strict military type home or strict religious type homes, these type of homes breed fear, insecurity, shame, and guilt, right? Extremely sensitive. What I do and how I act and how I feel about myself don't match what's going on internally. Hypochondriac, number three, hypochondriacs mentally or emotionally ill. So these are sick families, right? They have someone that's like a long-term chronically sick older person. Even worse, someone that thinks they're sick all the time. These homes breed a high level of fear, pessimism, anxiety, depression, distorted views of reality. They go to extreme measures that are usually to fix, manage, and control. Often very manipulative, Another one that's in here that's often missed is compulsive behavior in the home. What does that mean? I talked about it earlier, which is everybody can agree alcohol and drugs, using compulsively is bad, but compulsively overeating or undereating, compulsively spending, gambling, going into debt, compulsively working, OCD, homes like that breed some of the same symptoms, shame, fear, guilt, abandonment, as some of these other family types. Physical or emotional abuse. These are very obvious. If someone is physically abusive, whether it's verbally, physically or sexually, they also run rampant in some of the other family types. That's a biggie. The other one, which I see quite a bit in my industry in mental health and addiction, which are people that were raised in foster care, adopted, and then I group in divorce in this. Half our population is a product of divorce, so this idea of abandonment. My mom was raised in a, get this, children's home, so that's adoption or foster care. It was a strict religious children's home. That would be the perfectionistic the overly strict. And her mom, they were in there because her mom was emotionally ill. That's just one generation back, or I guess two generations back, and I'm already hitting three of them. Now, here's what's significant about these family types. They are exact mirrors to what I call the gold standard of dysfunction, alcoholism and drug addiction. If you round up, whether it's rounding up our probation department, criminal justice department, or a school, or just grab a group of normies, and you say, is it bad for someone to be raised in an alcoholic or drug addicted home? The entire group would agree the answer is absolutely yes. But often the ones that are overlooked are the other percentages of the family types that I just talked about. So many people, this is actually from ACA 12-step group, is the group was actually called Adult Children of Alcoholics, which are people that were raised in alcoholic homes, not only using alcoholics, but also people in recovery. But half of their population didn't have a using or a drinking parent or grandparent in their history or immediate history. Half the population, they're like, I don't have the alcohol bit, but I identify with what you are talking about, the shame, guilt, fear, abandonment, all the insecurity. And what they did was, after they researched it, they came up with these five family types that mirrored drug addiction and alcoholism. So what they did was they added and dysfunction to the 12-step fellowship, which is one of the most underrated 12-step fellowships out there. Just check it out if you want more information. So what are we going to do? What is my flavor of dysfunction? Now, this is going back to this idea of when I ask a group of people, do we need to do more for mental health and addiction? Everybody says yes, but what I also know, Ron, Amy, Cindy, because y'all are the only ones I can see, is most people say yes for them. Follow me here. The percentage of people that have the disease of addiction is about 1 in 10. Okay, these are very general figures. 1 in 10. Of that 10% of people that struggle with the disease of addiction, whether it's drugs, alcohol, or other addictive things, about 1 in 30 are in recovery. That means for every person in recovery, there are 29 that are using and abusing, right? But when I ask a group, how many people think we need to do more for addiction services? Everybody says yes. So 95% of the room is saying yes for them. That doesn't apply to me. So now they disassociate themselves, right? Which means they're actually contributing to the dysfunction. They're contributing to the stigma because they're not inclusive in this addiction side. Let's talk about mental health. About 1 in 5 struggle with enough mental health, what we would call diagnosable mental health issues, basic anxiety, depression, the more extreme bipolar, schizophrenic, that kind of deal, or score enough on a scale, on a mental illness scale, that they have to take some sort of medication. That's only about 20% of our community. So if I say, how many people think we need to do more for mental health services? The whole room says, yes, we do. But 80%, I would argue more, but most of the room says for them. So now they disassociate. Now they're part of the issue. They're part of the stigma. They're part of the dysfunction. Because as much as we want our friends and family to get the help they need, there's also that underlying stigma that's been passed down from generation to generation that something is wrong with you and I'm normal. So listen to this. Let's see if we can tap in to some of the flavors of dysfunction that we have in our broader community or maybe even in our immediate family. Question one, are there behaviors from our childhood or family that you thought were normal that you now know could be dysfunctional? Boy, I got all kind of stuff that I thought were normal that I now know are dysfunctional. Did you feel ignored as a child, or do you feel ignored as an adult? Another way of this is not understood or listened to. Is that a common theme in your life? Did your parents or relatives argue constantly? Were you asked to take sides? My son does that today. Holy smokes. Do you feel like you're a child inside? As an adult, do you feel immature? I think my wife accuses me of being as immature as my six-year-old almost every day. I feel like a child most of the time, even though I feel like I'm supposed to know what I'm doing. Do you believe that it is your responsibility to take care of everyone, or do you look to other people to solve their problems? What's interesting about these questions are people on both end of the spectrum suffer from the same illness. In other words, are you a fixer? Are you the one that tries to manage and help everybody? We call it, oh, I just care about them more than they do, right? That's how we dress it up. Are you a fixer, or do you play the victim, right? Both ends of the spectrum operate from the same root foundations of fear, insecurity, long-term family dysfunction. Do you constantly seek approval or praise but have difficulty accepting a compliment? Do you see most criticism as a personal attack? Do you overcommit yourself and then feel angry when others don't appreciate all that you do? Oh, I can't believe they don't recognize all the stuff that I do, yet you volunteered for it. By the way, I do most of this stuff, so it includes me. Do you think you are responsible for the way others feel or behave? Do you think you're responsible for how someone else is acting or how they behave? You think that reflects badly on you? Do you find it difficult identifying your feelings? When someone asks you, how do you feel, are you able to identify more than just happy, mad, sad, frustrated, and pissed off, right? If any of y'all like Brené Brown, she's got a great book out called The Atlas of the Heart, and also has an HBO, I think it's HBO, she has a special on it, that we should be able to identify, label, and communicate about 88 emotions in the moment, right? Most people can identify about three. Let's see. Do you involve yourself in other people's problems? Oh, I like that one. Call it spilling the tea. Let's gossip. Let's talk about everybody else. Do you feel more alive when they're in a crisis? That was one of the things when I was talking about epigenetics. Often, if mom has us either raised in a long history of stressful family environment or had a stressful, chaotic pregnancy, you know, people typically gravitate. As a matter of fact, when we talk about mental health, counseling, criminal justice, probation, oftentimes it takes just a couple questions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 questions to figure out why they gravitated towards fields like that. Often we think, oh, we just like to help people. But armed with this new information, you might figure out that actually, maybe I come from a long line of this. Do you confuse love for pity? Have you ever found yourself in a relationship with a compulsive or dangerous person and wonder how you got there? Do you judge yourself without mercy and guess at what is normal? All these are very, very tricky because, and I'm going to talk about me, the person that I present to you, confident, self-assured, decently well-spoken, can communicate. At any given moment, I don't feel good enough, smart enough, fast enough. I feel like a child. I don't think I can do it. I'm trying to communicate one way to you and almost pretend and hide how I feel inside. Do you act one way in public and one way at home? That's a big one. Do you think your parents had a problem with drinking or taking drugs? And do you think that if you were affected by the drinking or other dysfunctional behavior, or do you think you're affected by drinking or other dysfunctional behavior? So these are a handful of questions that are meant to invoke, maybe even if I don't have a mental health diagnosis, even if I don't have a drug addiction or alcoholic problem, even if I don't have some of the gold standard keys for the people that end up in our criminal justice system or in front of us at a therapy office or in a hospital, maybe I do have some variation of dysfunction more than I realized. And two, how do I help those people closest to me? I don't know about you, but the vast majority of people that call me, Ron and Cindy and Amy, is help my family. How do I help my wife? How do I help my husband? How do I help my kid? How can I help my son or brother? Right? They're trying to help someone in their family. Meanwhile, they don't realize the entire family and community has some form of dysfunction that they're all contributing to it. And because they're not getting arrested or have an alcohol problem, they think it's their problem. Levels of care. So this is one of the most important things to normalizing mental health and addiction. This is something that everybody needs to do from top to bottom, is basic level of care education, right? What is the difference between a counselor, a coach, a therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, volunteer peer-led group support, intensive mental health therapy in the form of groups, inpatient, residential? The vast majority of people don't even understand the difference in the basics, much less have the ability to start reaching out to these services before they end up in the hospital, arrested, or in an emergency room. Let me talk a little bit about the basics. 80 to 90% of people, hear me now, 80 to 90% of people will never need more services than what is listed here. On my triangle, we have five levels. 80 to 90% of our communities will never need more than levels one or two. But there's a lot of services in there, and most of us don't always know what's there, which ones we should utilize, or when someone asks for help, who we should refer them to. So let's talk about some of the basics. A coach. This is a life coach, a personal development coach, a leadership coach. They don't require a professional certificate. They're trying to move that way, but they don't require any kind of professional certification, although there are some coaches out there that are very well qualified. Coaches typically focus on goals, desires, potential, right? Where do you want to go? Who do you want to be? What are you struggling with, right? This is not necessarily the same as counseling, but coaches can counsel, but they're not counselors. It's not the same as therapy, but coaches can therapize a bit, but they're not therapists, right? Let's talk about counseling. Counselors, and there's all different levels of counselors. Counselors deal a lot with coping skills, self-esteem, handling emotional turmoil, emotional regulation, right? What happens when I get squeezed? How do I cope with anxiety, depression? These counselors are often have at least a bachelor's degree, if not a master's. Counselors can also get into different variations of trauma. They can specialize. They can do things like EMDR or cognitive behavior therapy, stuff like that. Now, do counselors coach? Absolutely. But a counselor is not a coach, and a coach is not a counselor. Let's talk about therapy. Oh, you have drug and alcohol counselors. You've got mental health counselors and supporters, etc. But there's all different variations, and we got to find our flavor, what works best for us. Therapy. These are social workers, psychologists, clinical professionals. Now, here we're getting a little bit more sophisticated, educated. You know, some of these people have master's degrees, some even doctorates. But that's when you get into some of the more deeper therapies, dealing with childhood trauma, PTSD therapies. This is not something to tread lightly, but this is more like level two stuff, right? So can therapists counsel? Absolutely. Can counselors do some trauma therapy? Absolutely. But they are not the same. And the good thing about our mental health system, mental health care system, which is if people are kind of, you know, keen on what's happening, is if they're working with a client that is too acute, that means too severe, they got a little bit too much going on that they're, you know, comfortable with, the hope is that they refer to someone that's a little bit more educated or geared towards that trauma or whatever that person is going through. So coaching, counseling, therapy, psychiatry. This is a biggie. Psychiatrists are a doctor who prescribe medication. Hear me now. Psychiatrists is a doctor that prescribe medication. They are not your therapist. Do some psychiatrists therapize? Absolutely. But the average psychiatrist is with someone for about 10 to 20 minutes. Some, if you're lucky, will spend an hour with you a month. Some might spend 30 minutes. But they are not there to listen to your clients, go through their day, go through their feelings, and deal with coping skills. They're there to figure out what symptoms are you going through and what medication do we need to prescribe. Psychiatric nurse practitioners, that's becoming a newer thing, but they are doctors of psychiatry and they write prescriptions. That is not the same as a psychologist. A psychologist is grouped more into the therapy part, highly educated, usually doctor's ID is a doctor in psychiatry, doctor of psychology. These are going to be people that are going to be doing like longer term sessions more often, right? So if your clients have a psychiatrist, that does not mean they're in counseling. They need to have both. Support groups. Now, these are twofold. I guess this is the lower version. Support groups. So these are, hear me now, the most underutilized resource in our communities. The most underutilized resource in our communities is peer-led support groups. Now, here's why. AA and NA are the most common because it's drug addiction. For families, it's Al-Anon. It's ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunction, Codependence Anonymous, right, for codependents or people that have the desire to fix, manage, and control. The reason these are so underutilized is because most people think they need to have some major element to go. In other words, if I'm not an addict, I don't belong there. If my dad's not an alcoholic, I don't belong in Al-Anon. If I wasn't used and abused as a child, I don't need to go to ACA. The problem is that most of us, this includes a lot of, you know, us and clients, most people are looking for reasons why they don't need it than why they do, right? Here's why I say it's most underutilized. It's free. Groups meet 24/7, 365 days a year. So most counselors or therapists can only see you at the max once a week, but most people are only seeing their counselor or therapist once or twice a month. So we have this lifetime of dysfunction. We have a lifetime of not being able to handle my emotions in a way that is responsible and productive, even if I'm not been arrested, even if I'm not an alcoholic, even if I'm not a drug addict, even if I don't have a mental health diagnosis. I've got years of this emotional dysfunction, and you think I'm going to fix it once or twice a month with the counselor. Here's the other thing. Counselors often take 6 months to get into, right? Often, for certain counselors, it costs a lot of money. If you don't have proper insurance, you have a high deductible. These are reasons why people don't go. But what they can utilize is free peer-led support groups. There's NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness. That's for mental health. Those are mental health support groups. Family groups. So if you have someone mental health in your home, NAMI Family Support Group. Those are a couple. Family of Addicts. I've got a whole huge list of them. Support groups are most underutilized and is what your clients and yourself should be in more often than not. This is kind of getting into a level of care for Columbus Springs. So levels 3, 4, 5. Now, I just made these levels up, but this is going to be your hospital, emergency room, Columbus Springs level of care, so psych stabilization and detox, partial hospitalization. This is intensive mental health and addiction group therapy 30 hours a week. Hear me, 30 hours a week. This is 5 days a week. So if someone goes to the emergency room because they overdosed or they're suicidal, homicidal, seeing stuff, it does not make any logical sense to send them back and say, go see a counselor once a week. They need to step down into what's called partial hospitalization or intensive outpatient therapy. IOPs, the orange, that is intensive group therapy 9 hours a week. So it's three days a week, 9 hours total. The other thing that's often confused and interchanged is inpatient and residential. Residential, alcohol and drug residential, is going somewhere for 30 days. This is Lighthouse Behavior. This is Recovery Works. This is Recovery Village. These are, you're going to rehab, right? Residential. Inpatient, if they go to Columbus Springs for 5 days, they're only in a hospital, inpatient for 5 days. That is not rehab, right? So this is something that clients need to understand, and the people making recommendations need to understand the differences. So inpatient, residential, partial hospitalization, the emergency room. Columbus Springs, here's just some basics. Dublin, it's actually called Columbus Springs Dublin, which is out off Perimeter Loop by Dublin Methodist Hospital. We have three units, acute psych, which is just severe psychiatry, right? These are people that don't really have a drug or alcohol deal. It's just straight homicidal, suicidal, psychotic, bipolar, that kind of a deal. The mid is like a dual group. So these are people that have mental health and addiction issues. And then we have an addiction unit for like, you know, medical detox. Unfortunately, and this is not a Columbus Springs thing, this is an insurance thing, opiates, heroin, meth, cocaine are not covered for detox. Okay. So if your clients are strung out on fentanyl and they want to go to treatment, Medicaid or any private insurance is not going to pay them to go to a hospital just to detox. They've got to have a mental health component. They've got to be thinking of hurting themselves. They've got to be hearing stuff. They've got to have some sort of mental health stuff that we can get them in under the mental health and then detox them while they're there. Alcohol and benzos are covered. If you quit alcohol or you quit Xanax or some of these other benzodiazepines, they quit, they could die. Insurance covers detox for alcohol and benzos. Columbus Springs East, that's over by the airport, kind of by Easton's area. They're both the exact same hospitals. One thing that's super significant about East is we have the GATE program, which is called, it's a transitional housing of PHP. So these are where people, they come in for detox or stabilization. They're with us for 3 to 5 days and they don't have a safe place to go. They're homeless. They've been accepted to a rehab, but it doesn't start for 10 days. We can keep them in that unit for up to 21 days while they wait to go to treatment. I can get into more detail. I sent Ron some details about some of these, and I'd really like, if you have questions, to call me after and we can kind of talk through it, but that's the GATE program. Levels of care, I covered a little bit about this. Adult inpatient psychiatry, so that's acute mental health. Medical detox, that's alcohol and benzos. Substance use, so these are people that need some sort of substance use stabilization. Think in terms of not, I'm ready to go to treatment because I'm in trouble. Think in terms of you need to send them to the emergency room. They're on the verge of being pink slipped. That means you can't leave because you're not safe. Blue slipped is what the police departments do. You're going to send them to Grant. You're going to send them to NetCare. Those are the clients that qualify for stabilization. Clients that this is, you know, they've dropped hot a couple times. They've told you that they need a little bit of help. They've got some mental health stuff going on, but they're not in crisis right now. Those clients are better fits for partial hospitalization, which is group therapy 5 days a week, or IOP, which is group therapy for 3 days a week. What do you do when this stuff happens, when your clients tell you these things, you need some help, or you're about to require them, like my probation officer did, you're about to make them go get an assessment? Call me directly. Let me know what's going on. We can coordinate it, plan it. That way there's no, you know, your client's not, oh, I called them, they didn't call me back, or they told me I didn't, or blah, blah. If we talk first, we can make sure that they at least follow through and figure out what to do from there. Changes Dublin. That's where we do our partial hospitalization and IOP. We also do it for pediatrics. So if any of your clients have kids that are struggling, these are teens, 12 to 18, that may need some services, we do pediatrics out at Dublin. We also do pediatrics and adults at Pickerington. So if they're more on the east side of town, they may be a better fit for Columbus Springs East or Pickerington. And then we can offer transportation. It can be challenging to do transportation, but it is an option. Again, you call me directly. Times, these are just some average times. Monday through Friday, 9 to 3. Saturdays, we do groups whenever we have enough people. Not always guaranteed, but 9 to 3 is PHP. And then we usually rotate times Monday through Friday, Tuesday, Thursday. We like to have like afternoon, morning, afternoon, and weekend, and evening groups, but we don't always have it. So again, it's not guaranteed, but we try to build them out as they come. So we know we have a mental health and addiction issue. It's not about mental health or addiction, it's about emotional dysfunction. It's not about the person struggling, it's about family and community. Now what? What might a mental wellness plan look like? Well, let's talk about physical wellness. Everybody and anybody knows that if someone comes up to you and says, hey, Amy, hey, Cindy, hey, Ron, I want to lose some weight and get fit, but I'm willing to work out once a month. Everybody would go, probably not going to help. Hey, Ron, I'm going to work out and I'm going to eat one good meal a week. Probably not going to work out, right? But they are willing to maybe work out 3 to 5 times a week, 30 minutes or an hour. They are willing to maybe join a gym or a group fitness class. They are willing to maybe hire a personal trainer if they've got a little cash, so someone to teach them. They are willing to maybe ask someone, hey, can I work out with you? Because you seem like you got a lot going on. Maybe you can teach me. They are willing to help someone new teach them, right? They're perfectly willing to work out, to look at their eating, to do physical activity, to set up some accountability and support for physical wellness 10 to 25 hours a week. But somehow when it comes to mental and emotional wellness, we're willing to do 1 to 2 hours a month of counseling, if that. So what might a mental wellness plan look like? We need to figure out ways for our mental wellness hours to match our physical wellness hours. So if we're willing to do 10 to 25 hours of physical wellness, how can we build up our mental and emotional wellness, our personal development wellness to match that, right? You can't, I don't care how much money you have, you can't see a counselor or therapist that much. That's when we have to use the most underutilized resources that's 100% free, 12-step support groups, family support groups, mental health support groups. That's how we're going to get our hours up. I'll tell you what mine is. I've got almost 21 years in recovery. When I was new, I did a lot more. I went to a meeting every day for 4 years. I participated in service structured. I sponsored and I was putting tons of hours. Today, I see a counselor once a month. I do a men's group, which is a 3-hour men's group, 2 to 3 hours a month, right? That's 6 to 9 hours a month. I go to a 12-step meeting. 5 to 7 days a week, I do yoga, which is a spiritual-centric yoga, not just a workout class. I do prayer, meditation, and journaling 5 to 6 days a week. I read daily positive literature. My wife is in Al-Anon family groups. Her and I go to couples meetings, right? This is 21 years later, and I'm still doing, I do inner child work. Oh, this is a fun one. I've only done that for the last couple of years. But if you add up my hours, today, 20 years later, I'm still doing 10 to 15 hours a week of personal, emotional, personal development stuff. It would be the equivalent of, and I'm going to wrap this up because I know I'm out of time. It would be just like walking up to someone who's been attending a religious organization for 20 years. They've been going to church, they've been active, etc. And they go, Amy, you've been going to that place for like 20 years. Aren't you done with that by now? Why do you still go there? Why do you still read that book? Or Cindy, who's been fit and watching what she eats for 20 years. And we go to Cindy and go, hey, Cindy, you've been eating well for 20 years. Aren't you done with that by now? In work, in our spiritual life, in our physical healthcare life, nobody ever questions how much time we put into it or why we keep going back. But when it comes to mental and emotional healthcare, when it comes to mental health and addiction, people go, you went to treatment for 30 days. Aren't you done with that? Can't you just go hang out with your family again? If we're going to move the conversation forward around mental health and addiction, we need to create a culture of do as I do, not do as I say. When I tell you all these things, I'm telling you from experience and I do them. When you talk to your clients and you say you need to do these things, you say, I see a counselor. I go to family groups. I've done parent support classes. I still do all these things, right? Just because I'm not getting in trouble, I'm still doing these things. Maybe you should try it. I find it way more impactful when I'm a do-as-I-doer, not a do-as-I-sayer. This is some cool, if you want to take a picture of that, this is some cool books, resources that are pretty neat. Talks about ACA, Al-Anon, Body Keeps a Score, Byron Katie, that's such a good one, Brene Brown, 12-Step Fellowship stuff. And then lastly, here's my information. I sent Ron a detailed information about Columbus Springs services, virtual tours, all the pretty pamphlets and stuff like this. But most importantly, if you're going to recommend to someone, make sure you reach out to me and give me an idea of what's going on so we can make sure that person gets to where they need to get and we can track them, get release of information signed. And you guys, thank you so much for letting me be here. And I hope I gave you a little bit of a different perspective that can help us move the conversation forward as a team, as a community, as criminal justice service workers, and try to help these people that are really struggling by helping our communities. Thanks for letting me share and letting me be here.